That's my Canadian pronunciation.
That's what's mine.
Let me be sure.
Here's on tap there.
The Legislative Commission on Pensions will come to order. Pensions and Retirement will come to order. We have three items on the agenda. They all relate to actuarial assumption changes. Members may recall that these are items that don't need legislative review. They are items that the Commission either adopts or doesn't. There may be some timing issues on some of the items. There may not be timing issue on the others, so we can use our judgment as to what we actually do today versus what we maybe hold off till January or February. I think members might have gotten an email. I presume it was copied to members. I've asked all the various parties, interested stakeholders in the pension area to try to get their ideas to my office or the commission. It was the 15th of the month, I can't remember. And the idea here is to try to organize our work in January and February so that we are done with our work prior to session starting.
There's a tie.
As best as possible. You know, perhaps we would need a meeting during session, but perhaps not. So, and I think we want to try to, as orderly as possible, do the work that's necessary. There's quite a few individual bills, and I don't know. We've done that with subcommittees in the past. I don't know how we want to do that. Is anybody interested in being on a subcommittee to handle all those individual bills? I see everybody jumping up for that one. Well, I'll consult with former members of that subcommittee. I think Bedsell's been on that.
But yes.
And
Representative Murphy, I think it's
Murphy's been on it. So we'll see if a subcommittee or whether we're just going to grind through them as a group. So, okay, why don't we start with the State Patrol Retirement Plan Assumption. Is that the first item? I think it is. And we're dealing with changes with withdrawal rates, retirement age pattern, mortality. Mr. Bergstrom. And actuary.
Yes.
You know, they never come up here on their own on these. They always have these high-powered actuaries.
Mr. Welcome. Chair, good morning. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And I have with me Bonnie Wurst. She's with Mercer Human Resources, and she is the actuary that does our valuations and also performed much of the experience study. The MSRS board decided to complete an experience study for the State Patrol and Correctional Plan in 2003, which was finalized in 2004. And what the experience study tries to do is match the demographic assumptions the actuary makes to what is really happening in the plan. For example, are employees living longer or shorter than expected? Are employees retiring earlier or later than expected? If those assumptions aren't accurate, the valuations that are done each year may not be accurately portraying the liabilities and the plan costs, which then go to determine the contribution rates. Mercer completed the study, and the results were reviewed by the LCPR actuary at the time, Milliman USA. So both Mercer and the Pension Commission actuary did agree on the assumption changes before you today. What is being recommended is in the State Patrol, fewer State Patrol employees who have 3 or more years of service and are vested are terminating and taking refunds. State Patrol employees are living longer than we are currently using in our actuarial valuations, and more State Patrol employees are retiring before age 54. And then I think I can mention the correctional plan when we get to that as well. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Wurst.
Welcome.
Thank you. As Dave mentioned, we did take a look at all the assumptions in both of these plans, but we'll talk about the State Patrol plan first. And the last time a thorough review and a thorough updating of the assumptions had been done was in 1997. And during that time, the plan had made some changes. The population continues to change. And one thing that has always happens in these experience reviews is that mortality and life expectancy change, and that does affect the cost of the plan. And so for the State Patrol, we reviewed and concluded that although the overall level of turnover, withdrawal, termination, the people who leave the plan before retirement, although the overall level in the State Patrol plan is extremely low, even with that, the actual experience was even less than that. Now, best practice in assuming when people will leave the plan in actuarial world has become something called, it splits the experience for the people who are new to the job, people generally within their first 3 to 5 years of experience, and separates their behavior from those who have been in the job longer. And we looked at it several ways for the State Patrol Plan, and we ultimately determined that that there were fewer than expected terminations for the people with 3 or more years of service. And so we're recommending bringing those rates down slightly. That's the first assumption for State Patrol. Secondly, it's mortality. The mortality table, we're recommending that it be strengthened to reflect longer lives. And that's a pretty standard recommendation coming out of most experience studies. And given that the State Patrol Plan is not large enough, doesn't have enough retirees to be statistically significant in the actuarial world, we did look at the experience. We did observe some trends from that, which is that, frankly, people are living longer. And then we recommended, in collaboration with Milliman USA and Tom Custis, that the mortality table be updated so that it matches the MSRS general plan, the large plan, which does get studied every 4 years and is using a standard actuarial mortality table, too. So longer life expectancy. And then the third change for State Patrol is it looks at when do people retire. And as I said, the last time assumptions were studied and updated in the State Patrol Plan was 1997. And since then, one of the things that happened during the course of that time was that the benefits for early retirement were improved. So in other words, if you want to take your benefit early, it's a little better benefit now than it was pre-1997. The reduction factors were reduced between that time. And what the experience showed is that there were more early retirements than had been assumed. And there were, we look at it year by year and make an assumption about how many, what percentage of eligible retirees will choose to retire in each year. And the significant finding there is that there were more early retirements than expected, but overall, predominantly, they were choosing to retire at age 55, as we had expected. So we made some changes to the pre-54 retirement rates and recognized the State Patrol mandatory retirement age of age 60 that had kind of been phased in and didn't necessarily affect everybody 10 years earlier. Those are our proposed retirement rate changes. We did look at other experience in the State Patrol Plan. We looked at disability experience, and we also looked at the mortality experience of those who are disabled. And comparing the experience to the actual experience to the assumed experience, we felt that the assumptions were reasonable and didn't need to be changed. We prepared an experience study. We submitted our recommendations to Milliman USA, and they considered them and they agreed with everything but recommended a minor change to how we were handling mortality. And ultimately, we agreed that the best way to handle mortality for this group is to put them on the same table as the general statewide plan. And we agreed to that, and those are the recommendations before you today.
Okay, thank you. On page 9 of the memo, just real quickly, so you did have Milliman review, or on point 2, Milliman did review all the recs, or just?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They reviewed all of them, disagreed with just one of the recommendations,
okay.
And they both came to an understanding and then approved all of the recommendations.
Okay. How about point 3 there, statistical reliability? There's some staff suggesting that in this instance there might have been a little more art than science here, or what's your thinking on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, the setting of assumptions.
It's not bad to have more art. It's just
no. This is one area in my scientific world where we use art because nobody can predict the future. But you look at the experience, and this is the smallest plan on the docket today, I think, in terms of the size and wondering whether it's statistically significant. But As an actuary, we are required to make our best guesses about what will happen with plan participants in the future, no matter how big or small the plan is. And so there definitely is art involved, and it's balanced by the experience, it's balanced by the observation, and then especially in the case of mortality, you definitely bring into play standard. You use a standard table that you feel is the best fit. The turnover experience, based on the experience that we observed in the experience study, we felt like we should reflect the lower termination to some degree. And because there's such small termination already in that plan, it has a pretty small impact. But we and Milliman agreed that that was the best conclusion from that.
So you both think this will be a little more accurate?
Yes, we definitely
would. Not with 100% certainty, but...
No, I will not place a bet on 100% certainty. That's not the objective, but to make our best guess and then to monitor it as it goes forward. And then one of the factors in recommending the retirement rates, when do people retire, is reflecting what does the plan provide. And the plan provides a pretty generous early retirement benefit, and it appears that members have been taking advantage of it.
Okay. And then I think we should just note on point five, the staff points out that we may want to be thinking about consistency across other plans the same way this has brought some consistency. So, staff, want to make any other points? Or we didn't talk about the cost implications either at page six. But Mr. Burke, did you say something?
Well, if you're going to go to the cost implications, I assume you want to go back.
Cost implications? Summary's on page eight.
Okay, we estimated the impact of making these assumption changes. And at the time of the experience study, we did do our study as of July 1st of 2002. In 2003 in the valuation, Mercer was not involved in that process. We were instructed and advised by MSRS to not run a parallel valuation for 2003, and that's why the results were done as of 2002. However, we've updated them to 2004, and those cost impact as of 2004, those are what was reflected in the contribution increase that were proposed by MSRS in this prior session. But the results are fairly consistent, and I think if we talk about them in general terms from page 8 in the middle of the page, there are three changes, and the most significant cost factor is mortality, the fact that people are expected to live longer. That increases normal cost slightly, but it increases your accrued liability and therefore your unfunded liability. It takes away the surplus assets that this plan had. So mortality has a big cost increase, about 5.5% of pay on an annual basis. Withdrawal, that was a minor change, and it has a minor impact, in total about 0.1% of pay. And then retirement, recognizing the earlier retirements, has a cost in total of about 0.9% of pay on this basis at this measurement date. So it's a pretty dramatic increase for a small plan, and one of the reasons for that is that the State Patrol plan has been a really well-funded plan with surplus assets. But over the last 4 or 5 years, that surplus has been depleting. And when you add in a recognition of longer life expectancy and the liability goes up, what it really did is it took away all those surplus assets. And so the unfunded liability is a really volatile, highly leveraged measure that can move from zero to X percent of pay pretty fast, and that's really what the mortality change does here. It costs a lot because it ends up recognizing and using all of your surplus assets.
Why are they living longer?
I
Mr. Chair, I'll try that one. I think just as in all walks of life, people, the health care is better, the health patterns are better, people taking better care of themselves.
So it's not necessarily unique to the type of work that's being done?
Not at all. I think it's seen across all of people in general. You get reports all the time that people are living longer, and the State Patrol employees follow along that.
Staff, want to add anything? Sarah Larson?
Yeah. On that question, what's the average age of retirement? What's the life expectancy from the time of retirement?
The average age of retirement is approximately 55, which is the normal retirement age in this plan. And for males, the life expectancy is now about 82, 83 years old, roughly. And so just shy of 30 years for a 55-year-old retiree. Females, life expectancy is about 4 years longer, 3 to 5 years longer. Although as mortality improves, what we're finding is that it's improving more for males than it is for females.
Mr. Chairman. What is the actuary? What do you say about the average age of retirement? 55. But what are their number of years of life from 55 to their predetermined or their death rate?
An average 55-year-old will live until his early 80s. So 27, 28 years. Is that
okay? Thank you.
Other questions? Staff, anything to add?
Members, what I would say on this regarding this topic is that I certainly can't recommend against you adopting the proposed assumptions that are before you. What I would do is make some brief comments about some longer-term issues. As I prepared this memo and the other memo dealing with the MSRS plan actuarial assumptions, I came to question the whole way we're going about this. What we have been doing, what was done in this particular situation, is we had the plan or system actuary prepare a study. The study indicated, for instance, on mortality, that although we have very few observations, there's some need to change. And then the issue becomes, well, how do we change? What do we adopt? Well, the easiest thing to do, given that you're dealing with, in this case, the MSRS system and that board, is to use as a fallback the assumptions that you're using for the largest plan within that system, in this case, the MSRS general plan. So the decision was made that the best new assumption would seem to be for this plan to adopt the same mortality assumptions that we have with MSRS general. Now, there's a tendency to do the same sort of thing when you're dealing with a para-actuarial study. If you have a study that indicates a need for some change and you're not quite sure where to go, the conclusion is likely to be, well, we should at least go in the direction of moving towards the assumptions we're using for MSRS general, or rather for para-general. What I would suggest is that given the data problems that you have, and you're going to have these whenever you're dealing with these smaller plans, for mortality and in the case of these public safety plans, things like turnover, is that it would make a lot more sense to start looking at comparable plans and seeing if there's any basis, if we have enough information to say that this plan is different than its comparable plan. In this particular case, the State Patrol plan is comparable to the Parapolice and Fire plan. They're both public safety plans. They both have employees statewide. And yet, if you look at page 11, which gives the current assumptions and the proposed mortality assumptions, you'll notice that the State Patrol plan assumptions currently aren't at all similar to the Parapolice and Fire assumptions. And the new assumptions that are proposed aren't consistent with Parapolice and Fire either. And this table also illustrates that by looking at this thing, sort of system at a time, we have currently some rather implausible results. For instance, the Parapolice and Fire mortality, it is currently assumed that an individual who joins Parapolice and Fire will have a less mortality risk than someone in MSRS General. So a paraplegic and fire member is assumed to have a better life expectancy, both while an active employee and a retired employee, than a typical state employee. That's a bit implausible. So I would suggest that rather than looking at these system by system, that it would make some sense to ask some more global questions. A question worth asking is, do we really have enough information to conclude that public safety plans are different than our general plans? Do we have enough information to conclude that our general plans differ from one another? Right now we're assuming MSRS General is different than Parageneral in terms of these mortality assumptions, and those are different than TRA. Perhaps TRA is a different animal. I really wonder whether Parageneral and Para and MSRS General are different animals. So there's a need to start asking those questions and to ask whether the public safety plans, whether there's enough information to conclude that they differ from the general plans. If there is there enough information to conclude that MSRS State Patrol differs from Parapolice and Fire? Right now we're assuming they do. The proposed assumptions assume that there will still be differences. And I frankly don't think there's enough information, there's enough data to really support that conclusion. So I certainly don't have better assumptions for you. It's certainly outside my area of expertise. I think that the best thing you could do in the short term is you might as well adopt the proposed assumptions. But I think longer term, we need to think about a totally different approach to our experience studies, especially for smaller plants.
Mr. Bergstrom, general comments on, or actuary or other fund directors?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem changing going forward the process. I mean, it's always good to review things that Mr. Burek suggests. The recommendations from you were reviewed by two actuaries.
No, not specifically on that, but just okay. The general idea of the point that he's making, that maybe a general policy for all funds may be as good as individual ones.
Mr. Chair, I think I would disagree a little bit. I think Okay. Each plan is unique. I'll just take two plans we administer, the State Patrol plan and the Correctional plan. Our disability experience is markedly different between those plans. Our disability experience may be different. So I think it's better to look at the individual plans. Maybe if you do them all at one time at some point, that makes some sense. But every plan, every group of participants is unique, and I think they should be looked at as individual plans.
Unique enough to have different assumptions?
Mr. Chair, I think unique enough to have different assumptions.
On all the factors or just some of them?
Mr. Chair, I just think on some of them. I think some of the factors we use are the same and some are different.
How would you separate those roughly?
It's worse. Mr. Chair, my take on this is that it would be valid to wait what we've waited so far, which is we see what the trends in this particular plan is. We've brought in, you know, some counter information from standard tables, especially on the mortality side. And I think it would be appropriate to bring in another case, which is what's happening in Minnesota and what is the experience of the similar plans, to look at them all, you know, if possible at the same time. However, I'd be reluctant to mix all of the data without also looking at it individually. So I'd be very open. I think that would be a reasonable way to look at things going forward, to really look at and understand what are the differences in these plans, or are the differences insignificant enough that we can standardize these. So I think it's a good idea. I think that there still will be individual weighting plan by plan, but with a plan as small as this, we definitely need to consider other outside factors.
On this point, any other fund director or actuary in the room that just wanted to comment on this point? Okay. Members, page one, or the last page of the packet is the appropriate motion if a member is interested in offering that. Representative Thiessen moves the commission approve the following actuary assumption changes as on page one. The last page of the packet. Resolution 05-1. Stakeholders in the patrol plan, any other comments? Okay, so any controversy that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of.
On the Thiessen motion, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, thank you. Let's then go to the...
Mr. Chair, just briefly on the correctional plan, some of the recommendations for that plan are similar to what have been made for the state patrol plan. We are seeing in the correctional plan fewer correctional plan employees who have 3 or more years of service terminating and taking refunds. Correctional employees are living longer, again, consistent with what we see in just the general population. The one recommendation that is different is that we are also seeing more correctional employees applying and being eligible for disability benefits. And that is one different recommendation in this change than the state patrol plan. And we are recommending a change on correctional employees and their early retirement. So 3 of the recommendations are very similar to what you've already looked at. The difference in the correctional plan is we have a fairly dramatic increase in the number of disability claims.
Cost, why don't you go through on page 10, the cost, table 11. Did you have, while we're looking for that, did Milliman look these over also? Yes?
Mr. Chair, yes, we did have Milliman look these over.
Any suggested changes?
Only in mortality, just as we discussed in terms of the state patrol. All right, the correctional plan has been an evolving plan. as the plan has grown and there have been a lot of people moving from a general plan system to a correctional plan system. And the funding and the assumptions have been kind of monitored along the way. And one of the things that we had heard and observed from the MSRS staff when we went into this experience study is that we have to look at disability. It seems like we're processing so many disabilities in the correctional plan, and are our assumptions appropriate? And what we found is that there were a lot more disabilities in this 5-year period than had been assumed. And that was consistent with what the anecdotal evidence and the administration side of the plan showed. The mortality, retirement, withdrawal information that we talked earlier, I don't think I need to go through again because it's real similar what we observed for correctional and what we observed for state patrol. The cost on page 10, in the middle of the page on table 11, the mortality improvement for the correctional plan, as of this measurement date, had increased the required contribution by 1.8% of pay. One of the bigger cost factors that we have here. The disability changes, which includes a recognition that there were more disabilities than expected, and also a change in the life expectancy of those people who become disability retirements. We combine those two together, and the overall impact of that change is a cost of 0.8%. The change in retirement rates, we recognized more early retirements, but there were changes made post 55, and the rates do end up hanging on with 100% of retirements assumed at quite a later age. So the impact of the retirement rate changes was different and opposite than it was for state patrol. It actually saves the plan a little bit of money. And that happens on retirement rates. It's an interplay between if you retire early, you receive the benefit longer, but if you retire later, you get a bigger benefit. And in this plan, there are post-fund increases and augmentation and further complications. But it was one of the smaller cost impacts, but an actual savings due to retirement. And withdrawal, which is the turnover assumption, the fact that people are staying in the plan more than had been assumed, had a cost of 2.1%. So the two biggest cost drivers are mortality and turnover. And the total impact is 4.2%. It increases. This was a plan that is already showing a deficiency, and this just exacerbates that deficiency, moves it from 1% below water to 5.2% below water on a percent of pay basis. So in both cases, we're talking about a pretty substantial impact, but the cost is there, and it's really a matter of getting the estimates right as you try to fund this plan.
How about point four of the memo by the staff on page 12? Apparently some disability information in the report is incorrect. Why don't you cover this point?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We reviewed the information that was raised and apologized for the typo. There was an error, and the disability information in the experience study is shown for each of the 5 years for males and for females, and then in total. And then in summary, we grouped the five-year data by male, by female, and by total. And there was there were typos in the summary of the total experience that grouped the male, the female, and all 5 years of experience together. And so, again, apologize for that. It was a typo. The male information was correct. The female information was correct. But 1 + 1 did not equal 2 in that table. And I realize that that is distracting.
So it didn't actually, the actual information and calculations were on the correct information.
Yeah, the actual information was correct. And okay. I'm happy to say that because the one of the recommendations is to have specific assumptions for males and for females, because in areas like turnover and disability, the experience is different enough for those groups. So the male information is correct, and we made a recommendation on that basis, and the female information is correct, and we made a recommendation on that basis. It was the totals that did not add up, and but that weren't really used in the setting of the recommended assumptions. So,
If you haven't already done it, could you just get some documentation in writing to the staff just so we...
Yes, I will.
So
I
if
will
someone
follow
ever
up
asks,
with a correction to that table.
Okay. We talked about cost implications. You know, members, I think this might be the moment to mention that we have a continuing challenge in the disability area. And that is controversial, but, you know, as chair, I've encouraged the directors of the affected funds to not shy away from it just because it's controversial. Obviously, the employee groups would like us probably not to keep picking that scab, but I think we need to, because there's been a court case recently, and I think this is a topic we will take up in January or February. Don't know if we'll be able to resolve it, but is it fair to say that the fund directors affected are pretty concerned on the trend line we're on?
Mr. Chair, in our correctional plan, we're very concerned. The MSRS board looked at depth at this issue. We have some specific recommendations for you to consider as well, and we think it's an area, as it reflects in the cost, it's 0.8% of pay. And that's a substantial cost. And if we don't bring it under control, that could go up. So I would recommend, and I believe PERA is interested in looking at the issue too.
So my thought was that we would look at it in January, February. The funds are hesitant to put down specific recommendations now because I think there may be an appeal on the case that just came down. But I don't think general discussion by the commission would get in the way of any court action here. And when might that be determined by the court on that case? Could that be in the next month or two?
Mr. Chair, that's...
Ms. Vanek? I'm trying not to say more than I'm supposed to here. Am I doing okay, or have I said more than you want me to say?
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. I don't know what to say either. All I know is the petition to have the Supreme Court review the appellate court's decision was due today, and it was filed by our legal advisor on Monday. I was told by our legal advisor we could expect a quick response to whether or not the Supreme Court will review the case, and that if the decision is to go forward to review, that we should not expect that to go before the Supreme Court before midsummer.
Why don't you give us the court? What is the case?
It is the Stephen Britton case versus PERA, and it is a decision by the appellate court by two of the judges, the third one dissenting, that basically defines any active duty as just being on the job. And that is not historically how the para board has interpreted a duty disability for purposes of that benefit. And so we are challenging what we perceive the intent of the legislature as described in our purpose statement, is that the duty disability is awarded for the particular dangers inherent in that public safety work, and not necessarily is extended to just incidents that occur on the job that could occur in any other work environment. So we have to wait and see if the court will review.
If members are interested, perhaps some of the lawyers on the commission might be. Ms. Vanek has provided me information on what's going on there. Representative Thiessen's shaking his head. He looks like he'd like you to forward that information to him also. Oh, she did. Okay. Any other members interested in the briefs and things? Okay. If you are, let the staff know. I think it's fair to say that even before this case, there are concerns about the where we are on the whole disability situation. So we'll take it up in January and February. We obviously would like to work with the affected employee groups on it. But I think even the employee groups, there's a growing concern that there may be an over-usage here. So I'm not saying everybody in the employee groups feels that way, but some do. Mr. Martin?
Members, if you, in your packets for MSRS Correctional, we give you a two-page summary of the actuarial work year to year to year. And that includes membership information, and this would be
second or third page back. Here.
Right. I'm looking at the 2004 through 1998 table. There's a membership box up on the top, and after active members and service retirees, there's a disabilitant line. And if you just track back 154 disabilities in 2004. Only 49 disabilitants back in 1998. That's a sizable jump in the number of disabilitants in a relatively short period of time, and that's the item of our concern. If those are actual disabilities, that argues for maybe better job circumstances. If these are marginal injuries or marginal circumstances that are being pushed to a major disability benefit, that may mean that our disability benefit standards are not correctly stated.
Is there some, could some of that be explained by the general demographic of the workforce? People are hitting an age where these things happen or not?
Mr. Chair, some of that, but we are just seeing more and more even employees at younger age applying for disability. So it has something to do with an aging workforce, but it's more than that.
Okay. Okay, so that was a bit of a sidelight, but that is an area I think we need to maybe bear down on here.
Mr. Chairman, could they submit a list of those cases to Mr. Martin so we could take a look at some of those?
Ms. Vanek, Mr. Bergstrom, did you hear Senator Larson's request? What's the possibilities there? Senator Larson's asking if a list of those situations, those 154, or what kind of information you could provide within privacy to allow members of the commission to kind of figure out what's going on there.
Mr. Chair, we've done a breakdown that we can supply as how many are in the line of duty, out of line of duty, what type of disability it is, and ages and length of service. So we'd be happy to provide some of that data.
Why don't you update whatever memo? You've done a memo on this for us previously. Why don't you update that, and maybe even Senator Larson's particular interest, maybe try to catch him in the next month or so and sit down and visit with him? Okay.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we can do likewise. We've got a lot of data, and we can certainly sort it out and provide whatever you wish.
Great. Thanks. Okay, then on the last page, we have a similar motion of approval of the assumptions. It's the 05-2.
That's two pages.
Last what? Pardon?
Two pages.
Oh, last two pages. Okay, who wants to? Wardlow makes that motion. Discussion. Affected employee groups, any comments? Any controversy on this set?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any controversy.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much. And the last item, Minneapolis Fire Relief. Members, I've visited with the Relief Association and the city, and they're not all kind of on the same path quite yet. So I think there's no urgency to do this today, but we should either yay or nay before probably May next year. So I think view today as a kind of a opening discussion of whether we should move ahead here or not. So,
good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commission members. My name is Walter Shermer, and I'm the Executive Secretary of the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association. The issue brought before you today is a concern that was expressed to us by our actuaries. This actually surfaced about 2 or 3 years ago. And we've had discussions with the city on a couple of occasions. And approximately 2 years ago, we were asked by the city to wait before we try to implement this new mortality table. We agreed at that time, and now it's been 2 years now that this has been waiting. So we're bringing it forward for your consideration. And your assistance in trying to get ourselves on the right page, according to what our actuaries recommend we should be using as a mortality table. I would like this to use a euphemism of our attorney, Brian Rice. He says it's like we're wearing a size 9 shoe when we actually have a size 10.5 foot. This table doesn't fit our organization, so we'd like to address that issue and move forward on changing it to something that fits a little better so it's more comfortable for all of us. With that, I'd like to introduce Mark Meyer. He's our actuary, and he can give a brief explanation of why he brought this to our attention.
Mr. Meyer, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mark Meyer. I'm a fellow of the Society of Actuaries. I work with Van Nuys, Ward & Associates, and my client is Minneapolis Fire. It's my pleasure to be here, members.
They call them fellows?
Fellow of the Society of Actuary.
Is that like the Elks or the...
I have a
client... Like the Eagles?
Calls it a black belt. I'm a black belt actuary. That helps.
Pleasure is to be worse, here. Or were you a black... Are you a black belt?
I mean, what's the next step down?
Brown.
Or something.
All right.
I had the pleasure of working with Ms. Wurst, and so she learned everything I know plus more, so she's very well qualified to be here. I'd also like to introduce my colleague, Paul Kruger, who has been instrumental in doing this study and is an important part of this team. I'd like to give you just a little bit of background because the Minneapolis Fire is unique in that it is a closed fund. There are no new members. At the end of December of 2004, there were 42 active firefighters still working. That was down from 58 in the prior year. On the other hand, there are 438 current retirees, down from 1 in the prior year, and there are 176 surviving spouses. That's the surviving spouse of a retired firefighter. So we have a unique situation where it's a closed fund. And that makes this group older than any comparable group that you heard about today. Very important distinction and some background. Then I'd like to just call your attention to the staff memo and some other background. In Appendix D, Attachment D, Mr. Martin has laid out some common mortality tables on page 2i. And it shows you the 83 GAM, group annuity mortality table.
Let's get there.
Oh, sorry.
D.
S and D. You just missed it.
Members found that yet? Looks like this.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you for keeping us on. The UP 1984 table is the one currently being used by the fund and has been used for a very long time. I call your attention to this page because you see there are other mortality tables that are commonly used today. You'll also notice that each and every one of those has a life expectancy that is longer than the UP 1984 table. For example, if you go down to the column that says age, 70, under the UP 1984 table, the current life expectancy is 81.7. The 1983 GAM table is 83.2. What that means is that if you live to be age 70, then you can expect to live another 11.7 years under the UP 1984 table, and under the 83 GAM, you can expect to live another 13.2. The other background item, if you go to the very next page, there's an inventory of actuarial assumptions for all of the statewide and major local funds. And you'll notice that each and every mortality table begins with the words 1983 group annuity mortality table. Now I'd like to call your attention to
which is report. GAM on the previous page. That's GAM?
Oh, yeah, GAM. I'm sorry.
That's
Thank
the
you.
First column on the previous page.
Yes. GAM is group annuity mortality table. In the packet that you have is our report, and I will not go through each and every page, but I'd like to highlight a few things. That will be just a few pages after where we just were. It's a mortality table dated July 2005, prepared by Van Nuys Worden Associates. You can return to page one, which is the introduction and actuarial certification.
What's it look like?
Looks like this.
Okay.
One of the duties as the actuary is each and every year we measure the liabilities of the plan using the actuarial assumptions that are in place. With that information, we determine the appropriate amount of contribution to keep the fund actuarially sound. That's especially important for this fund because there's no new members. So the day of reckoning, while it's probably 30 years in the future, is close enough for actuaries to pay close attention to this. One thing that we noticed when we became the actuary was that the table UP84 was being used, whereas all of the statewide funds used 1983 GAM. That in and of itself is not bad, but it was worth noting. Then each and every year we measured expected mortality results to actual and discovered, not to our surprise, that people were living longer than the table would have predicted. Now that would be good news to ordinary people, but to actuaries that's bad news, because that means you got to pay people longer and the liabilities are greater than what we are disclosing. One year by itself doesn't mean very much, especially for a fund of this size, which is quite small. So we waited until we had 5 years of data, did an extensive mortality study, and came to the conclusion that the current table didn't fit very well, and in fact, we were understating liabilities. We presented that to our client, the Board of Trustees of the Minneapolis Fire, which consists of firefighters, both retired and active, two members from appointed by the city, and at that time it was decided not to proceed because they asked the same question that's being asked today: do we have to do it now? Why now? And the answer is there is no set time when this must be done. However, there is a point at which the judgment of the actuary will be that the current assumptions no longer meet generally accepted actuarial principles. Under our rules of ethics and conduct, we are permitted to use the assumptions that the state tells us to use, and we will continue to do that until we have your approval to proceed. But for the coming actuarial valuation, December 31, 2005, if we don't change the assumption, I will qualify the opinion for the Minneapolis Fire to say that I believe the mortality assumption does not meet actuarial standards. It doesn't have any financial impact, but it will mean that I will have fulfilled my responsibility as a professional actuary. As Ms. Wurst alluded to earlier, we're required by our profession to come up with our best estimate, given all the facts and circumstances, of what we believe to be the best fit. In doing this, now I'm going to ask you to turn to page 9 of our report. And I'm skipping much of the fun details of how you do a mortality study and showing you what I presented to the Board of Trustees as alternatives. We are unable to predict the future, but it is our duty to disclose the liabilities to the best of our ability. The current actuarial liability using the current mortality table is $276 million. We identified three variations of the 83 GAM table that one could argue fit this situation, some better than others, and often it's in the eyes of the beholder. In the end, what we are recommending to our client, and they have adopted, and we're asking you for your approval today, is to move to the 83 GAM group annuity mortality table that's denoted as F plus 2. And what that notation means is that we would use the standard table as presented for males, but for females, we would assume that they are 2 years older than their actual age. So if there's a woman that's age 70, when we go to the table, we would assume that she's age 72. See some quizzical looks. Why would that be? The current table that's being used for the other funds, remember, is used for post-retirement mortality for people who are age 20, for example, today. So we're trying to predict what their life expectancy will be 60 years from now. And it's going to be better than it is today. For this group where there are no new entrants and the average age is much older, we don't anticipate that much mortality improvement. So you're going to see that this mortality table does not have the same life expectancy as some of the others in the statewide funds.
Did you mention the average age to us already?
No, I'd be happy to do that. The average age of an active employee, and there's only 42, is 53.7.
53.7, all right.
And the average age of a retiree is 68.7. And the average age of a surviving spouse is 78.4.
Okay. Thank you. How many retirees were there again?
As of December 31st, 2004, there were 438 retirees.
And spouses?
176 surviving spouses.
Thank you.
Without going into further detail, I would say that we conferred with our client and came to the conclusion that the best fit, based on the mortality, even though it's not an exact science, in fact, it is an art, we applied that, came to the conclusion that the best fit under these circumstances is the 1983 group annuity mortality table with no adjustment for males and with a 2 year set forward for females. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Okay. Why don't we hear from the city, then probably you'll be back up here. So,
just ask one quick question.
Representative Tyson.
Thank you. Just looking through the numbers here, it looked like that last one on that table 5 you're showing matched up more closely to the actual experience in terms of the mortality assumptions. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Why the F plus 2 instead of that F plus 3, M plus 1 was recommended?
Chairman Pogue-Miller, Representative
Thiessen, that's fine.
Thiessen, okay. There's several things that we consider there, and one of the underlying features of mortality is that it's continuously improving. So we talked about it, we used the term shelf life. We could adopt today a table that, the one you're referring to, which is on this page 9, 83 GM F plus 3 M plus 1, produces an actuarial liability of $297 million. That's $21 million that we're currently disclosing. We could do that today, and I think it would be an accurate fit, but in our opinion, it's ignoring the trend of continuing improvement, and we wanted to pick a table that would last for approximately 10 years. And we also wanted to pick a table, and this is the art of actuarial science and also the judgment of the actuary. I'd like to have a table where it's equally likely that we'll have more people die than expected as less. In my opinion, that table would not accomplish that objective, and we would probably have continuing losses, although they would be lessened because we'd have a more robust mortality table. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah, that does. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Sherman?
I'd like to leave the current discussion and wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, because I probably won't see any of you before that happens.
You're pretty
so
smooth.
So Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You're pretty smooth.
Well, I mean it.
Mr. Shermer didn't call you up as the actuary and say, come up with something here that'll put more property taxes on the city? You basically, this when you took over the account, you basically looked through and decided, because of the difference on the mortality, that was something worth looking at?
Yes.
Because of the different table being used?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for it. That's a point I wanted to make. It has now turned out that for this group, because it's a closed group and everyone's retired, the only demographic, in other words, non-economic assumption that matters, that has any material impact, is mortality. So that is the one we focused on, and I can guarantee you that the client didn't come to us and say, we would love to have you do a mortality actuarial experience study.
Mr. Rice didn't call you up and tell you?
No, sir.
All right.
But we did suggest to them that in order for them to meet their fiduciary duties, they should do one. They accepted our advice. We did the study.
Mr. Senator Pogue-Miller, just one quick comment. The last time this table was looked at, and I think Mr. Martin reflects in his memo, was changed, was in the early 70s. So put yourself all back 30 years and what you assumed about how long people were living, and we're operating with something that's, I guess Senator Larson was here, and maybe Senator Lance, but not many others of us. No offense, sir.
You know, I don't know, 30 years ago, the city's coming up. Thank you, gentlemen.
We'll stay around for any further questions.
Mr. Meyer, I just remember when I was 30 years ago, I just thought if I made $12,000 a year, life would be good.
I thought five.
You thought five.
When I was young.
Isn't life good?
Well, life's good, but $12,000 a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I just want, before you get started, because you may say something where I won't want to say this, but no, just kidding.
I've been known to do that to you, Senator.
I don't know if everybody noticed in the paper, Mr. Moyer is going to be leaving the city, and just on a personal level, I've found it's been exciting working with him, and found him very straightforward, tough, and so I think that's a loss for the city. So, Mr. Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Scottish. Full disclosure, I'm Scottish. Okay. So, obviously, I'm going to oppose this proposal.
Just can't get along with anybody.
Oh, actually, I do get along with these guys.
All right.
Okay. You never personalize your disagreements. I've learned that in life as a young budget analyst, a state budget analyst, I might add, many years ago. It's been a privilege to work for the city and to advise you. And so, you know, my budget director has prepared a speech for me, and I'm not going to say any of it. I warned her about this, okay, before. Here, I'm just going to cut to the chase, and it's going to be very simple, and I'm not going to talk to you about actuarial RMs or whatever, you know, RPs or whatever. I'm just going to talk about the reality of life, okay? Reality of life in pensions is about full funding. And if you change one assumption of all these assumptions, there are like at least 8 major assumptions that deal with the valuation of assets and deal with the valuation of liabilities. I gave this lecture to my class at Hamline last week, so I'm really on top of this game, okay? Actually, they enjoyed it, too, because, you see, if you understand this stuff, you can have better investment performance personally, okay? But the point that I'm getting at is if you change the mortality assumptions do not change the benefits paid to the pensioners. The members of this association will not get a bigger check because of the change in the actuarial assumption in the short run. If you change one assumption like mortality, you end up, in this proposal, having the city with a pension fund that is underfunded. It's not fully funded. Liabilities and assets do not match. They're around 92% funded, right, Wally?
Pretty accurate.
Thank you, Wally. So you don't want to change one assumption that increases the liabilities without adjusting the assets, because you can adjust the assets. The asset assumption, the annual return on investment, Wally, is what,
6%?
Actuarial, right. That's lower than other funds in the state. And so what this does, basically, it increases the liabilities by $32 million. And you end up decreasing your funding ratio from 92% to probably somewhere near 80%. So
page
we go
six,
backwards. We go
page
backwards.
Six members is where that number is.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And so what my caution to you as a civilian almost is think about, let's get fully funded first before we start adjusting things. And if you want to start adjusting actuarial assumptions, then you should look at all of them, not just one of them. You should look at both sides of the equation. You should look at the asset assumption. You should look at the liability assumptions, okay? And that's how you do due diligence, and that's how you add value, and that's how you have a well-managed pension plan. Okay, so my budget director is mad at me. We've given the clerk the copy of the testimony, okay? But that's the bottom line to me. Let's get fully funded first before we change things, okay? What's the motive behind changing the one assumption? I'm not going to judge that. You guys can figure that out. But I'm just saying to you, let's get fully funded first. Let's not put more burdens on the taxpayers, okay? Let's respect both the beneficiaries of the plan and also the taxpayers who have to foot the bill. And that's the end of my testimony.
And how about the point that Mr. Meyer just made, that on a closed fund, the only one that's really going to matter here in terms of the 7 or 8 factors is the mortality one, in terms of big picture? You think that may not be the case in this fund? Or?
No, I don't agree with that. And I think that mortality, the city's on the hook for whatever the mortality is. We're on the hook for the benefit payment, whatever the mortality assumption is. Okay? So if we're wrong and they live longer, then we're going to pay more. We're going to pay it out as it becomes due. Okay? All right? So I'm just saying.
So why wouldn't the city want to be more accurate now so that you can pay that over hopefully investment earnings and stuff?
Because the city has only a limited capacity to pay. We don't have an infinite amount of property tax levy authority. I mean, we can't do that to
you. If you didn't have a limited ability to pay,
we have a tax policy.
From a technical point of view, would it be better to do it sooner rather than later?
No.
Why?
Because it's abusive to the taxpayers.
No, no. If you set aside the notion of ability to pay, let's just say you had the money. Property values were just skyrocketing in the city, and you know, an extra million here or there didn't make that much difference. Is it better, just from a purely technical point of view, to adjust these things earlier rather than later, or not necessarily?
I think the actuary for the Fire Relief Association has said that there is no certitude to the statistical probability of this. Okay.
Actuaries talk that way, huh? No, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry. I digressed.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that a little bit, I think you raise an interesting point. My sense from what the actuary, and I forget your name, sir.
Mr. Meyer
was saying is that it seemed like on the assumptions he was talking about is not on the investment assumption side. It was more the demographic assumptions. And
right.
That comment made sense to me that with a closed fund, you're not going to have people going on there's fewer people that would go on disability or would retire early and all those kind of things. Would you agree with that?
What I would agree with, Senator, is the fact that...
I'm not sure if that's...
Mr. Chair. Okay, Representative Thiessen. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to promote you.
Whoa. That's two strikes.
Yeah.
No, it's not going well, Mr. White.
That's okay. It's okay. It's my last time before you guys. Okay. So, anyways, I'm just saying... what is certain? There's one certainty about actuarial assumptions. They're always wrong. Okay? And so you have to have some kind of statistical significance to judge a change in an actuarial assumption. And this does not exist in this case. And a bottom line, common sense approach to funding pensions is do the right thing on both sides of the equation. You want to match your assets with your liabilities. And so what this does is increases the liabilities but doesn't adjust the assets, except through taxation and property tax levies on the citizens and taxpayers of Minneapolis. So I don't think there's any urgency to this. There's no crisis here. We'll be fully funded probably in a couple, 3 years, okay, based on normal market conditions. And the last time the Fire Relief Association was fully funded, it was almost 110% funded prior to the market crash of 2000 to 2002.
It's lost it.
And they wrote a check, a bonus check, to their members of $10,000 per member. So I think prudence would dictate that we stay the course, get the full funding, and if you want to consider one actuarial assumption change, you should consider all of them. Okay, I'm done.
If I could just go ahead. I was going to say on page 9 is what the city is the tax issue. On page 9, is that the difference between 2.3 and 5.4? Is that basically?
I don't have that in front of me, Mr. Chair.
It's on page 9 of the. The amortization payment, is that?
Excuse me, Mr.
Is that 2.3 to 5.4, that difference, is that basically a property tax increase? Bottom line from the financial side of this for the city?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask, can you tell me as to why it is best for the taxpayer who you say is on the hook for this obligation, why it's best for the taxpayer to give them false assumptions if you know the information that you're telling them with their future liability is wrong? Why is it good for the taxpayer to continue that illusion?
Mr. Chair, I'm not suggesting that at all. What I'm suggesting is that the actuary for the association has acknowledged that the total number of participants during the study period, and I'm quoting their report, the total number of participants during the study period are too few to state with statistical certainty. That's truth. Statistical certainty to actuaries is truth. That a change is required. There is no statistical certainty that a change is required. We don't have enough data. So I'm saying we shouldn't burden the taxpayers, which include the commercial industrial property owners as well as the citizens of Minneapolis, with a burden that is unnecessary. We're going to be good for the benefit payments. We're on the hook for the benefit payments. The members are not going to get a less check if we don't do this, okay? In fact, because we are funding something, we're throwing $32 million more into the pot, okay? Over time, they're going to have a larger asset pool, so they will get a bonus check sooner than later. Okay? That's what we're talking about here, bottom line, end of day. So I hope that clarifies that, Representative.
It's I don't know if we ever get to where we have absolute certainty with these things. But
there is no certainty with actuaries. They're always going to be wrong.
I just listened to a fellow that said that you're wrong.
Okay, that's fine. I've been wrong before, and I admitted it, but I'm not wrong on this one. Okay.
Well, I think what Mr. Meyer said was that he was using his best professional judgment as to what should be done.
I always use my best professional judgment, Senator. Okay.
We have two professionals who have different judgments on this.
So, there's only one professional in this room that's responsible for the entire organization and the entire city. Okay? I'm not a special interest group. I represent the government.
Oh, be nice now.
Okay.
Him being here, they don't do it, right?
Be nice.
Okay. I'm done.
I don't think Mr. Meyer is a special interest group. He's an actuary, you know. So
he's on contract with the special interest group. Okay. Thank you.
Well, he's kind of frisky today.
Yeah, Mr. Frisky Chair, there. This is my last time before you, so I'm letting it all hang out.
Well, I think what you said at the end there was kind of what the concern ultimately is of the is that there will be higher benefits paid because of the increased assets in the fund.
Correct.
Now, what certainty do you think there is of that? Or that's just your sense that that's a possibility?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I managed two pension funds when I was a finance director in Wichita, Kansas, and that was a big deal. And I also created one when I started New City out in Washington State, and I know what I'm talking about. And I have next to my bedstead Ibbotson and Cinquefield's bills, bonds, stocks, and inflation. You know,
well, that's why you're so frisky. Anybody reading that at night? Say, what is the mechanism? Maybe somebody should just remind us. What is the mechanism that kicks in an increased benefit there potentially? What's the?
Mr. Chairman, like three different ones.
So, thank you, Mr. Moyer. Any
thank
questions
you.
For
thank you,
moment?
And have
okay.
Good you. Session.
On the last point that he made there, what's the mechanisms that potentially, if there's more assets in the fund and investment returns are greater, what could potentially create a higher benefit?
Mr. Chairman, Commission members, there's actually three stages. It's one that's below 100%, there's one that's at 102, and one at 110. So they play in at different stages of funding.
So if you hit that, what happens?
Each one has a different formula. And the formula is pretty complex. Maybe Brian Rice could explain to you the specifics of it.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Rice, Minneapolis Fire General Counsel. the post-retirement benefit is based on performance investment return compared to pay increases. If that benchmark is made, which the investment return has to be 2% greater than the previous 5-year salary increase, at less than 102%, 1% of the assets are paid out, 0.5% goes to the state, so the state makes money, and 0.5% goes to the members up to 1 month's check. After 102%, it's 1.5% of assets, and when it's over 110%, it's apportioned 20% of the assets over 110. The key driver, I think Mr. Moyer, all due respect to Mr. Moyer, this is a red herring. If the fund's investments go up and more assets are made in the market, that's a bigger determinant of what the levy is. And investment returns are going to generate whether there's a actual investment return percentage is the determinant factor of determining whether a post-retirement benefit is paid, not how much the tax levy of the city is. The amount we're talking about here is about $3 million. If you were to implement this table now for last year's actuary study, that's all going to change this year. My guess is the funding percentage of this fund is going to go up.
And I think Mr. Moyer's point about this somehow is going to drive higher pensions, well, it may have an effect. It's de minimis. It's extremely small. The major driver of the post-retirement benefit is investment return, and that doesn't have anything to do with mortality tables.
Anything else you want to add?
I know Mark had a couple.
Meyer? Mr.
Chairman, I'm Mark Meyer, and first of all, I'd like to say that I know Mr. Moyer, and I really respect him, and I've told him more than once that I only hope to do my job as an actuary as well as he does his job for the city. Mr. Moyer is an expert on city finances, and I am an expert on pension funding. One thing that he brought up, and I think it's a common misconception, is that actuaries create liabilities. We do not. We do our best to identify and quantify the reality of the situation. The reality is that the liabilities that should be disclosed are higher than are currently being disclosed. In my professional opinion, I have a duty to bring that forth, and I have done so. The second comment that I just wanted to point out is that the additional benefit targets are based on a funding percentage. And if we adopt a stronger mortality assumption, we will go backwards from 90.2% funded to 80.7%. So when the Board of Trustees agreed with my recommendation that we should have stronger mortality, they knew that they were reducing benefits for members in the short term. But that was outweighed by the fact that in the long term, we have additional certainty that we will not have an emergency sometime in the future. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I can make just three quick comments. First, the question has been raised here about the sufficiency of the numbers. You just approved two experience studies, both over a five-year period, which is the actual order standard, and you dealt with the patrol. In that case, you had 69 deaths in a five-year period, and you expected 105 deaths for males. You had 30 deaths for females and expected 39. In the correction plan, you had 81 deaths and expected 92. And for males and 19 female deaths, expected 16. In this group, a similar group for fire, in this similar five-year period, you had 88 deaths and you expected 114, and you had 70 female deaths, expected 71. If the city's position is right that this stuff is too small, then they should have got up here before and said, don't vote for the correction plan, don't vote for the patrol plan, because you're both dealing with similarly small groups. And in fact, the study that Mr. Meyer did was bigger than the ones that Ms. Wirtz did in terms of participant mortality issues. The second point that you need to think of, I think Mr. Meyer pointed out something significant. Every other plan you're working off is working off this GAM 83 table. Everyone at this point that's come before you, and they're doing some variant on that. And when you get into the public safety plans, the variant is very small, within a range of minus one for PRA, and minus two for MSRS to no offset for MFRA, at least the proposal. So you're dealing in the same pool, the same actuary table, a more current actuary table, as compared to this last one when your colleagues, probably Senator Larson was the last one who reviewed this some 30 years ago, and he was on the Pension Commission. It's really time to update this. And again, all due respect to Mr. Moyer, the fund, I sit on the board and there. Year after year, Mr. Meyer came in and said, there's a leak. We're seeing water on the floor. He traced it back to mortality. I mean, there's a hole in the roof. And you just, at some point, you say the assumption just isn't right. It just doesn't fit anymore. And I think when you look at it, all due respect to Mr. Moyer, Mr. Meyer makes a great point. By the fund trustees doing this, they're actually pushing themselves further away from that date. They get to 102 or 110. They're punishing members to some extent, but they're doing their fiduciary duty and being realistic and honest with their members, with the city, and with the commission. I think it would be a breach of their fiduciary duties. In fact, Mr. Meyer said this at some point. It would be the trustees would be breaching their fiduciary duty not to bring this to your attention.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. I think we'll set this one aside unless members feel an urgency. This won't affect anything unless we don't do something before, I think, June.
Mr. Chairman, just on the timeline, it would be the
Mark, you could answer this. When is your next actuary report due?
Me?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, we will be performing another actuarial evaluation as of December 31st, 2005. We usually begin that in March and have that completed by the 1st of May.
Okay, so we should do it before May or before March. We should do it fairly quickly, okay.
Ideally, yeah, now. But
if we were going to change it, when as the actuary, when would you like that done, if we were going to do it, in terms of the timetable you just described?
Ideally, March 1st.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chair. Thank you.
Representative Bosman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, with regard to some of the comments that Mr. Moores made, he made it sound as though this was a an action that was actually going to have increased benefits to the retirees. If that would be the case, then I'd have a conflict of interest on this. My understanding is, though, that because I'm a member of this pension, I'm a member of your pension.
Yep.
But it was my understanding that this was a movement to make this pension more responsible in their assumptions, and it was just, and it was actually going to lower us further away from the 100%, and that's where that where we start, where the actual additional benefits increase. And so this wasn't going to increase benefits. This potentially was going to delay any benefits that may be coming down the road, but it was a more responsible way for us to go forward. I didn't feel any conflict in trying to make this a more responsible effort. So I'd like to know if I could get some clarification on that. And Mr. Myers is a expert in that area, and I'd like to verify, is this action actually increasing benefits, or is it just stabilizing the fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond, Mr. Moyer mentioned, there's many factors that affect the funding level of the pension fund. And for this fund, there are only, in my opinion, three assumptions that matter. We're assuming a 6% investment return, 4% increase in salaries, and this mortality table. And that is in order of significance, of importance. So by adopting this new mortality table, we will take a step backwards. That will have the effect of increasing the amount of money that goes in. But if we then have more money and suddenly have a run like we did in the 80s, where good investment performance takes over and we earn 16% a year instead of 6, it could result in additional benefits sooner. Not because we adopted the mortality table, but because we had more money in when the market got hot. So it's a complex answer, and so it could have an effect on future benefits. But the immediate impact is to take us farther away from future benefits.
I thank you for that clarification. That's helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Martin wanted to add.
Actuarial valuation of assets is one of the
factors here.
As a fourth
factor that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the actuarial value of assets is a method of smoothing out the ups and downs in market value of assets. And it is a short-term factor, but it doesn't have the longer-term implications that the first three assumptions have.
And how is this fund different than, is there smoothing on this fund?
Yes, there is.
And what is it?
Excuse me,
Mr. Martin may know. Do you know? Nope, go ahead.
I'm referring to the actuarial report dated May 2005 for December 31, 2004. I'm sure this is on file too. The method is takes the book value of assets and then adds to that the 3-year average of the difference between market and book. And that is an attempt to smooth out.
Okay.
It's not my favorite method of actuarial value of assets, but it, under the current circumstances, it's not a material problem.
It's different than the statewide plans.
Yeah, it's different than statewide plans.
I think it's
the only
point
that wanted to be made here. So.
statewide plans are?
Members, it's a somewhat complicated system, but it's a five-year smoothing odd device based off of current market with add-ons or subtractions based on the actual versus the expected growth in assets over time.
Okay, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. I would encourage the fund and the city to continue visiting. Commission will take this up again at some point. So, and we'd obviously, well, it's obviously easier for the commission if there's a consensus at the local level. But, you know, I guess we get paid to make decisions whether it's easy or not. So,
that's right.
Senator Larson?
And, Mr. Chairman, I just, you know, listening to this and thinking about it, and I know the post-retirement fund and the funds outside the post-retirement fund, it seems to me that it would be nice to have if Mr. Martin would have the time to put together a memo about the comparative value of the post-retirement returns versus the various other funds, because I think down the road sometime that all of these funds are going to have to be part of the post-retirement to make sense out of some of these retirement plans. So I think it's something that we should look at because, you know, we've had the post-retirement fund since 1971, and if you look at the rate of return, it'd be kind of interesting to see what the rate of return for post-retirement is versus the various other funds, and just for our own information.
Okay, he'll work on that. Is it okay with members if we, I mentioned at the beginning that we'd try to do the work in January and February as much as possible. Does that work for members? You know, I don't intend to have tons of meetings, but Representative Wardlaw.
Just to clarify, I'm going to be a grandfather maybe February 15th, so if that...
Get it done before that.
Yeah, or just don't see me.
It would be helpful if members do have vacation plans and things, yes. Just to let the staff know. They don't have to tell me or anybody, but because we want to schedule meetings where members can participate as best as possible.
Senator Langston, we have a couple of weeks of capital investment tour, and I think the week of the 9th and the week of the 23rd of January, so we work around that if you would, because okay. We're involved in that.
Have we forwarded, we have been getting, we'll get out a memo on what I've heard from the various funds and stuff on what the issues are going to be here. I'll try to get everybody something before the end of the year about kind of what we're all going to take up here. On the Minneapolis Teachers Fund, where I was headed personally was I was thinking something has passed in the Senate. The commission obviously can continue to discuss, but let's see what can pass in the House. And then try to piece something together. Obviously, the commission perfectly willing to bring up the discussion here again and more. And I think the Senate would like to do whatever the House feels is necessary to move the ball here. I don't know that running another bill through the Senate is going to change anything at this point. But we're open to, I think it's fair to say the Senate is open to something different than what we passed. But we have passed something, and so I think we need to keep the momentum going. That would be my sense of it. And if the House wants to do something a little different than that, we can try that too. But I think where we are is we would like to work with whatever the House feels they can pass and then try to get it done in an orderly fashion. I really do think we should try to get something done this session. More expensive.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, the pre-69 bill, too.
Well, that's in what the Senate passed.
Yes.
The House knows what the Senate's passed, what we were able to pass at 50, and I think we had 54 votes. I think we understand that what the House may want to do and what the governor may want to do will be in some aspects different than that. Fine. Let's just figure out what it is and see if we can't come up with something here. So is that... Yeah, and I've had this conversation with Representative Smith. I think he's open to proceeding that way. It just seems like that's kind of the best way to function here. Try to get something done and then work it out. And it's an important issue, and so I want to make sure the House knows that I have no intention of trying to jam something or to do something that is not well understood. I think we ought to do this in as open as fashion as possible and just try to get it done. This is kind of the canary in the mine shaft for potential other issues in the future.
Okay.
And I think we need to figure out a way as a group to get through these things. So, okay?
All right. Great.
Anything else? Thank you, members. Have a good holiday.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.
You.